Good evening, I'm John Yang. Amna Nawaz and Jeff Bennett are away. On the NewsHour tonight, today's jobs report shows hiring is slowing, but so is inflation, with the latest economic data signals for American workers. As a Texas law banning gender-affirming care for transgender children takes effect, families grapple with the potential consequences. And districts seek new ways to deal with pandemic learning loss. One potential solution? Lengthening the school year.
In this once-in-a-century moment, we need once-in-a-century responses.
Welcome to the NewsHour. We got the latest snapshot of the U.S. economy today in the August jobs numbers. They portray a healthy labor market that's steadily growing, though there are signs of cooling in the face of the Federal Reserve's higher interest rates. Employers added 187,000 jobs in August, while the unemployment rate ticked up from 3.5% to 3.8%, a sign that more Americans are looking for work. In addition, downward revisions to June and July numbers put the average monthly job gain over the last 3 months at a relatively modest 150,000, down from an average of 238,000 from March through May. At the White House, President Biden hailed the 32nd consecutive month of job growth.
More than 700,000 people joined the labor force last month, which means the highest share of working-age Americans are in the workforce now than at any time in the past 20 years. People are coming off the sidelines, getting back to their workplaces, and the lowest unemployment rate in 70 years for America's women.
But add today's report to earlier economic data, you get a complex picture of the current economy. Catherine Rampell is a NewsHour special correspondent and Washington Post columnist. Catherine, let's talk about the jobs numbers. What was your reaction to the jobs numbers?
I think it was generally a good report. Look, these are not the same kind of gangbusters job growth numbers that we saw earlier when the economy was first reopening, but those kinds of numbers were never sustainable. So a pace along the lines of what we had last month is generally a healthy pace. It's slower than it was. That's kind of what the Fed is looking for, honestly, at this point. They want to see evidence that the supply of jobs is about matching the supply of workers, or the demand for workers is equal to the supply of workers, essentially, and we're headed in that direction. I think that there are some concerning signs in the economy, which we can talk about, but for the most part, this was a pretty robust report.
And was there anything below the big numbers, sort of the top line numbers, any patterns of who was getting jobs that you found significant?
I think the unsung heroes of this labor market to date are two categories, immigrants and women. You heard Biden just now talk about how women are more than punching above their weight. If you think about a few years ago, there were lots of concerns about the so-called she session disproportionately hurting working women, particularly working moms, throwing working women basically back a generation because of the disruptions in childcare, disruptions in schooling that had taken many of them out of the workforce or out of their existing jobs. That has not materialized. If anything, women are doing better than ever, at least in terms of their participation rates in the labor force and their ability to hold down a job. So women are basically kicking butt in this economy. The other category is immigrants. If you look at who is joining the labor force, why the number of workers has grown quite a bit, it's primarily because of foreign-born workers. Relative to pre-pandemic levels, the number of native-born workers is about flat. It's slightly up, and that's largely because native-born Americans tend to be older. They're more likely to be retired, et cetera. Foreign-born workers are more likely to be working age, they're more likely to be in the labor force, and the normalization of the immigration system, which had been set back quite a bit by the pandemic, has enabled many of those foreign-born workers to contribute to the economy and fill those jobs.
Earlier this week, we got numbers on consumer spending, on inflation. We've seen consumer debt delinquencies on credit cards, auto loans rising. Are these signs of concern?
I think they're a little bit worrying, yes. I don't want to use the dreaded R word, recession, and I don't think we are there yet. There's no sign that we are there yet. But there are some vulnerabilities that are clear in this economy. Americans have spent down their extra savings, or a large part of their extra savings that they accumulated during the pandemic, both as a result of forced saving, essentially not traveling and not going out and dining out and things like that, and also a lot of those fiscal policies, those various government transfers that had helped people amass more savings. They've spent a lot of that down, both because time has passed and because prices have been high, et cetera. You see the result of that in those rising credit card delinquency rates, for example, in the lower savings rates that we've seen recently, and some other signs of stress throughout the economy. And we don't know the full extent of the consequences of the Fed's rate hikes to date. I mean, the whole point of those rate hikes was to tighten financial conditions and to make it harder for people to borrow and make it less likely that they would spend money. That's a feature, not a bug of all of that. But there is a lag between when the Fed raises rates and when it's ultimately felt. And so we don't know how much more is working its way through the system at this point and how much additional pain that could cause later on.
Catherine Rampell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In today's other headlines, Florida's Big Bend region faced another long day of cleaning up from Hurricane Idalia. One utility said today it could take 2 weeks to repair badly damaged electrical grids in rural areas. The storm also wiped out scores of homes in coastal towns. And officials said area farmers are facing a catastrophe.
We are going to sustain tremendous agricultural losses. And when you think about the impact that that has on our communities, the jobs that it provides, the local economic impacts, it will be felt very, very strong and deep.
Estimates of insured losses alone range as high as $9 billion. And Idalia may not be finished yet. It's back over the Atlantic, and forecasters say it could again become a tropical storm as it heads toward Bermuda. The White House is asking Congress for another $4 billion in supplemental disaster aid. That would bring the total request to $16 billion in the wake of the hurricane, the Maui wildfires, and other events. The request is expected to meet resistance from Republicans who say the federal government spends too much. Two more former members of the far-right Proud Boys were sentenced today for their January 6th crimes. Ethan Nordine got 18 years in federal prison for seditious conspiracy. That ties the longest sentences given out. Dominic Pozzola was given 10 years for leading the attack to stop Congress from certifying the 2020 election results. As he left the court, he shouted, "Trump won." In the Russian-Ukraine war, Moscow says its forces intercepted a new wave of drones attacking deep inside Western Russia today. Officials report that one of the drones targeted Kurchatov, home of a nuclear power plant. There was no word of damage to that plant. Today, officials in Kyiv warned of more to come as pro-Ukrainian partisans step up cross-border operations.
Concerning attacks on the Russian Federation, there's a growing number by unidentified drones launched from within Russia. These will increase. This is the stage of the war when hostilities are gradually being transferred to territories inside Russia.
Meanwhile, the Kremlin said that on Monday, President Vladimir Putin will discuss Black Sea grain shipments with the president of Turkey. In July, Russia pulled out of a deal that allowed safe passage for vessels carrying Ukrainian grain. Japan held nationwide earthquake drills today, marking 100 years since its deadliest quake ever. The drills simulated a major tremor striking central Tokyo. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his cabinet wore matching uniforms as they walked into his office for an emergency response meeting. Officials said that the Great Kanto quake of 1923 showed the potential for catastrophe. It triggered an inferno and killed more than 140,000 people. Back in this country, the Biden administration proposed what would be the first federal rules for staffing at nursing homes. Care facilities would be required to have a registered nurse on site around the clock. The proposed rules also call for staffing equivalent to 3 hours per resident per day. The administration says the new rules would make residents safer. The industry says they would cost billions of dollars and make existing problems worse. And on Wall Street, stocks surged after the jobs report, then gave most of it back. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 115 points to close at 34,837. NASDAQ fell 3 points, and the S&P added 8. Still to come on the NewsHour, Ukrainian forces make slow but substantial gains in the country's southeast. The longstanding problems plaguing the Atlanta jail where former President Trump and his co-conspirators were booked. And David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A ban on gender-affirming medical care for transgender youth went into effect in Texas today, making it the most populous state to date with such a ban. An estimated 30,000 young people in Texas between the ages of 13 and 17 identify as transgender. The new law revokes the medical licenses of any doctor who provides minors with gender-affirming medical care, like puberty blockers, hormone treatments, or surgeries. Beyond Texas, gender-affirming care for some 300,000 young people who identify as transgender is under threat. Laura Barrón-López has been following all of this. Laura, what is the situation in Texas right now?
Right now, the law is fully in effect, and it's going to ban providers from giving puberty blockers, hormone treatments, surgeries, which are very rare for minors, to transgender youth in the state of Texas. And it's also going to require that if any of these patients are currently receiving those treatments, that they're weaned off of it. Now, advocates on the ground have told me that that ultimately already providers and pharmacies are not even trying to approach that weaning off, that they just simply are going to stop providing treatment altogether.
And are they still fighting this in court?
They are. So what happens next is that litigation is going to continue to play out even as this law takes effect. And ultimately, the Texas Supreme Court is going to decide whether or not this law is constitutional under Texas's state constitution. But I asked the Texas Attorney General's office what their response was to this law taking effect. They said that they are going to enforce it fully, and that this law, they claim, is designed to protect transgender youth from these, what they say are damaging gender transition interventions. Now, it's important to note that all of the major American medical associations say that this is gender-affirming medical care, helps transgender youth, that it often prevents suicidal ideations, and that it is their professional recommendation that transgender youth have access to this care.
You've been tracking a young transgender girl in the Austin, Texas area and her family. How are they reacting to this?
A few months ago, I traveled to Texas to speak to Leah, Mary, and John, who Leah is a 12-year-old transgender girl in the Austin, Texas area. And I spoke to them today about what they're feeling right now in the aftermath of this law taking effect. And we changed their names and provided anonymity due to the fact that families like theirs are facing threats.
It kind of took my breath away, even though we were expecting it. I guess I just had some hope going into this.
And have you two spoken to Leah about the fact that this law is going to go into effect? How is she feeling right now?
She did specifically ask us, like, are we going to have to move? I don't want to move. I love school this year. I love my teachers. I have friends. And so, you know, we're just letting her know that at this point, we're just going to do what we need to do to keep her here, but still, you know, do what she needs. And I'm hoping that that's going to be enough and that we don't have to pick up and leave at this time.
It's an emotional day for the family. They told me that they feel like it's a betrayal by the state, that they love living in Texas, and they really don't want to have to leave. But that ultimately, you know, right now, they're put under a lot of stress to find care for their child.
And what are they going to have to do to find that care? What's the road ahead look like for them?
Mary and John told me that at this point, Leah is ready for puberty blockers, and puberty blockers would pause her development into puberty, into a gender that she does not identify with. And so right now, they received a referral from their previous provider to seek out care in New Mexico. New Mexico is a 12-hour drive for them from the Austin area, and they're essentially waiting to hear whether or not they're going to be able to schedule an appointment.
We're going to have to make arrangements with the out-of-state providers and really start thinking about how and when and how often we need to go. Make those plans with our employers, you know, obviously take time off. More than likely, they'll have to be school time off to be able to do this. So it's definitely a situation where it disrupts life, you know, work, school, financially.
A lot of disruptions to their life, John, and Mary did call that clinic today, but again, they don't have any word yet on whether or not they're going to get an appointment. And if they are not able to get an appointment at that New Mexico clinic within the next 6 months, Mary and John told me that they're going to have to look at other states very quickly, and that those states could be even further away, cause more disruptions and more financial burden.
At a news conference about 3 months ago, you mentioned this family and what they're going through to President Biden. At the time, the president sounded like he might call them. What's happened since then?
Well, the president, John, has not called the family. But today, the president did direct his senior advisor for public engagement and a liaison to the LGBT community, Hannah Bristol, to call the family. And she called them, and a White House official told us that on behalf of the president, Bristol expressed that the president stands with Leah and her parents at this time. Bristol also told the family that the president believes that parents like them, Mary and John, should be supported and applauded for what they're doing to help their child. And now Mary and John also told me that what they said to Hannah Bristol, and they said that they expressed some frustration with the fact that while they appreciate the supportive words from the federal government, that they feel as though they haven't seen many actions on behalf of the administration, and that they specifically told this White House senior advisor that, quote, anywhere I go, I don't know what's going to happen next, and that they feel as though they're tiptoeing through their life in Texas. Now, Hannah Bristol told them that they should always feel free to contact her, to contact the White House, to share the experience that they're going to, and that they would be in touch with the family throughout this process.
How does this Texas law fit in with all the other laws that are or sort of enacted around the country?
John, 22 states have laws on the books that ban some form of gender-affirming care for transgender minors, meaning they either ban puberty blockers, hormone treatments, or surgeries, or all three. And more than half of those states' bans are fully or partially in effect right now. Some of them have yet to take effect, and others have been blocked by the courts. Now, I spoke to a lawyer with Lambda Legal today who has been fighting on behalf of these families who have transgender children in courthouses across the country, and he described all of this as a patchwork of litigation, a patchwork of legislation that is putting families in an untenable position. And so families like Leah's are having a lot of uncertainty, are going to have a lot of uncertainty over the coming months and years.
Laura Barrón-López, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For months, Ukraine's military has been grinding through a counteroffensive designed to liberate Russian-occupied territory. Kyiv has admitted that it's been slow going. But over the last 72 hours, Ukrainian soldiers have made what the White House called today notable progress. Nick Schifrin reports on the counteroffensive and a population eager for that progress.
In a city at war, the first day of school is held underground. In a Kharkiv metro station turned bomb shelter, children sing the words of their national anthem. Our enemies will die, and we will live happily in our land.
After our victory, we will celebrate the first day of school very differently.
But that victory has felt a long way off. For weeks, Ukrainian special forces in southern Ukraine have been fighting through thick Russian defenses. They've taken casualties, targeted on the ground by Russian artillery, and from the sky by kamikaze drones. Ukrainian soldiers have been stymied by massive minefields pockmarked with craters. They use American technology and armored vehicles to hunt and detonate mines, trying to create a corridor to drive through. And last week, they achieved a breakthrough, a village destroyed but recaptured. Robotyne lies on Ukraine's most critical access, toward the city of Melitopol, on the way to Russian-occupied Crimea. And in the last 2 days, Ukraine also says it captured Verbove. Both villages lie within heavy Russian fortifications marked in red. In certain places, Ukrainian soldiers have now breached the first line of defenses and are confronting the second line. Deputy Defense Minister Hanna Mylar said on Ukrainian TV today.
The enemy is much more fortified there, and in addition to the mining, we also see concrete fortifications, and our armed forces have to overcome a lot of obstacles in order to move forward.
Ukraine also appears to be moving forward with attacks inside Russia. On Wednesday, drones struck a Russian airbase. Satellite imagery showed military planes in Pskov before and after the attack, some destroyed. The base is only 20 miles east of NATO member Estonia. It's also 400 miles from the Ukrainian border, which just so happens to be the range of what Ukraine says is a new weapon launched this week. But the attacks on Russia are launched from Russia, senior advisor Mykhailo Podayak said today.
All this is being done by partisan movements or an agent network operating on the territory of the Russian Federation.
Podayak also said today Ukraine would only stop fighting when it, quote, destroys Russia's military, even if that, quote, continues for some time. For more on the state of the counteroffensive, we turn to Doug Lute, retired Lieutenant Army General and former U.S. Ambassador to NATO. Doug Lute, thanks very much. Welcome back to the NewsHour. How significant is it, as we heard from the Deputy Defense Minister there, the Ukrainian forces have breached some of the first lines of Russian defenses, most notably some of these minefields in southern Ukraine?
Well, Nick, I think it's significant because they have actually beaten the Russians on this first line of defense. But I also think this first report should be cautioned because there are subsequent lines, at least as bad as the one, that is severe as the one they just penetrated, that lay in front of the Ukrainian advance. So it's good news, but it's mostly so far a tactical success without great operational significance.
So they've gone through some of these first initial lines, which are mostly minefields, and then they come to the second line, which are concrete barriers. And we have video of some of these barriers. They're known as dragon's teeth. What is the challenge there? And you see them right there. And there are hundreds of miles of these across southern and eastern Ukraine. What is the challenge that those fortifications pose that's different from the challenge posed by these big minefields?
Well, if the Russians followed their own doctrine, most of the heaviest minefields would be those in the first line of defense, so the line that reportedly the Ukrainians have already penetrated. The subsequent lines of defense will feature, if doctrine proves true, fewer mines, but physical barriers like the ones that you just mentioned, and also ditches which impede the movement of both wheeled vehicles and armored vehicles. Those together still form an effective line of defense and can channel and focus the Ukrainian offensive, making it a target for Russian counteroffensive.
Give us some perspective. How difficult would this task be? Again, across hundreds of miles, through minefields, through concrete fortifications, how difficult would that be for the American military?
Look, in the menu of tactical tasks that American armored and mechanized infantry units train towards, this is the most difficult. At the National Training Center in the Mojave Desert in California, where we train our mechanized forces, when American units attempt this task, they typically fail perhaps 9 out of 10 times and have to do it over and over again to attain proficiency. So this is very tough. It's especially tough for the Ukrainians because they don't have all the assets they need. They have insufficient mine clearing and obstacle clearing materials, typically manned by combat engineers. And they also don't enjoy much air support because the Russians still have heavy air defenses and actually along the line of contact dominate the air scene. So they're playing with some very significant disadvantages.
The National Security Council Communications Director John Kirby said today that there would be, quote, reinforcing and pushing back on some of Ukraine's progress on the Russian side. So what might the Russian response to some of these tactical successes be?
Right. Well, so as we've already discussed, the good news is apparently the Ukrainians have penetrated the first belt. The bad news is there are subsequent belts, of course, as we've discussed, but also it's now clear where the Ukrainian focus is, which means that in turn, in response, the Russians can focus their replies. And what I would expect is attempts by Russia to attack the flanks of this Ukrainian penetration, where arguably the Ukrainians will be vulnerable. So there'll be a real move and a real priority afoot by the Ukrainians to deepen the penetration, but also to widen it and to protect its flanks. And that's what we should watch for in the next several days.
And Doug Lute, in the 30 seconds or so that we have left, we have seen a Ukrainian claim of a missile with more than 400 miles range. We've also seen Ukrainian drone strikes deep inside Russia. Again, quickly, what significant do those two announcements make?
Well, I think twofold. First of all, Nick, it shows that the Ukrainians have an indigenous, homemade capability to strike the Russian homeland, and in particular to strike those military targets from which the Russians have been launching strikes on Ukraine, to include Ukrainian civilians. So that's important. And then second of all, psychologically, it's a big reminder to the Russian people that they're at war.
Doug Lute, thank you very much.
More than 3 years ago, schools received the first installment in what would become the biggest ever one-time infusion of federal money dedicated to education, about $190 billion to protect against COVID and reverse the academic setbacks that followed the pandemic. School districts used the money for a variety of purposes, from tutoring programs to building upgrades. Some of the districts, like one in Virginia, used it to add more days to the academic year. Earlier this month, Jeff Bennett visited a school there to see how that program is faring.
At Fairfield Court Elementary School, addition comes easy to these third graders.
Even when they're all broken up into little ones, we can still imagine that you can form them back into a big what?
Hundred.
A big hundred. You guys are so smart.
This year, they've added 20 more days to the school year, starting class in late July. It's part of a pilot program that Richmond Public Schools introduced to combat pandemic learning loss. Math is 8-year-old Kimora Arrington's favorite subject. She says she's excited about the extra time in the classroom.
I like to come to school to read and get smarter and smarter and grow up. School belongs to me, and I want to learn to get in college. That's why I always come to school every day.
Kimora was in kindergarten when the pandemic started. Her dad, Daryl Arrington, says he noticed his young children drifting off during virtual instruction and was one of the first parents to sign them up for extended school.
I wanted the kids to basically have a fresh start as far as when Yale last year, they learned this, but when they come back, they can refresh their minds so they won't lose focus. I hope my kids gain a lot of experience for as far as learning, a lot of education, purpose, and a lot of love.
In 2021, the federal government gave school districts the third and final installment of pandemic aid money, $122 billion, with a requirement to spend at least 20% of those funds on helping students recover academically. In this district and others nationwide, the learning loss debate centers on time and whether to use that new money for more hours in school. After pushback from some teachers and community members, only 2 of 55 Richmond public schools adopted the pilot program. On July 24th, state and city officials welcomed students at Fairfield Court for their first day in class after a 6-week summer. That morning, Richmond Public School Superintendent Jason Camras said maintaining the status quo was not an option.
The pandemic really set us back, and we know we had a lot of challenges before then. And so in this once-in-a-century moment, we need once-in-a-century responses, and that is what we have here today.
Richmond is a notable example of what researchers call a national crisis. From 2019 to 2022, the city's third through eighth graders lost the equivalent of a year and a half in math and reading instruction. The city's Black and Hispanic students make up roughly 85% of public school enrollment and faced the greatest fallout. Nearly all students at Fairfield Court live in a neighboring public housing development under the same name. In the fall of 2020, Angela Wright became their principal, but didn't actually see students in person until the following year.
That was hard for relationship building, just to see how parents really suffered going through the pandemic and even trying to get their kids on board with education.
She built support among parents and staff for the 20-day pilot program as an opportunity to combat pandemic and summer learning loss.
What was your initial reaction when you heard about this program to extend the school year?
The summer learning loss for Fairfield Court and our students was real. Our kids would come back and it's like they had lost everything they had learned. So when our superintendent presented it to all, that was something that I was like, wow, that would really benefit our students.
Teachers receive a $10,000 bonus for working the extra month and an additional $5,000 after reaching certain academic goals. During the pilot, Damon Hunt's teachers have introduced him and his classmates to more hands-on learning, like field trips.
We've been testing sign experiments outside, paper airplanes. I like the field trips. The field trips were like super fun. We got to go swimming. Like, yeah, it was pretty cool.
But opponents of changing the traditional school calendar say the district already has underfunded needs and shouldn't add more days to what they call a broken system.
I think partly the motivation for extending the calendar was the mentality that the pandemic created issues that were not there, but that is not so. These issues have been rampant in Richmond Public Schools for years.
Nettie Suarez is a high school teacher and the president of the Richmond Education Association, the city's teachers union.
I think a better way to use that money is to have smaller classrooms, focus on teacher retention, improve the quality of our buildings. Right now we have buildings with mold.
Suarez also points out that when the district surveyed parents and teachers about changing the status quo nearly 2 years ago, the majority voted to keep the traditional calendar.
Were you prepared for the initial pushback you faced when you floated this proposal?
Well, I think anytime we introduce change, there's going to be a pushback.
Richmond Public School Superintendent Jason Cameras says schools could only participate in the program if they showed strong support among parents and staff. He said students have already passed the first test, attendance.
It's going to all come down to student achievement, student satisfaction, teacher satisfaction. But I can tell you one of the first indicators we look at is, did the kids show up?
In the first 20 days, Fairfield Court had an average attendance rate of 90%. The program is an approach education researchers say works under certain conditions.
The evidence does suggest that more learning time, whether it's in the form of extended school days or school years, intensive tutoring or summer schooling, does in general, when it's done properly, make a difference in student achievement.
Thomas Tock is the director of Future Ed, an independent education think tank at Georgetown University. He supports the extended school pilot program in Richmond, but says there is no one-size-fits-all approach on how to best spend the federal funding.
In some places, the absence of air conditioning or heating in schools, it makes learning very difficult. And so what we've seen is that less affluent districts, often in rural communities, are spending some of their federal monies on HVAC systems and on updating their textbooks and other things that more affluent districts sort of have been able to afford in the course of their annual budgets. It's hard to assess what's right in a given community without understanding the circumstances in that community.
Richmond School District officials argue additional days combined with small group tutoring will positively impact students now and in the future. This year, Fairfield Court will have 5 tutors for students struggling to keep up.
If this program is effective and does help these children academically, will the position of the union change?
Absolutely. Our position is what works best for all students, what is equitable for all students. And so that's why we want to make sure that everyone understands that these are 2 schools. How many students are in these 2 schools? As opposed to continuing to lose learning in other schools, because we're short staffed, because we're underfunded. That's really where the problem is.
The district used part of its pandemic recovery funding to pay for the program, which cost $2 million between both schools. School districts have a September 2024 deadline to budget the remaining federal funds, but one major question is how programs like Fairfield Courts will be funded after next year.
I've been fighting really hard at the state level. Virginia currently has a $3 billion surplus. I believe a huge chunk of that should go to Virginia's public schools to support programs exactly like this.
The results from this pilot will help the district decide whether to push for a similar approach at schools in the years to come. The extra month in class has already inspired Kimora to choose her future career, a school teacher.
I can help students to count and do Praiseville blocks and put them in college, and they could grow up to get them own house, their own car.
But right now, there's still 20 minutes left in math class and a chance to make things right for these kids.
The Fulton County Jail in Atlanta became front page news last week as the place where former President Donald Trump and his 18 co-defendants surrendered to be booked on felony charges. Many spent just a matter of minutes there. But as William Brangham reports, it's a much different story for the jail's long-term residents.
John, just this week, two prisoners at the Fulton County Jail died while in custody. That brings the total to 9 who have died there so far this year. These jailhouse deaths are not limited to Atlanta, of course. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 1,200 people died in local jails in the U.S. in 2019. That's the most recent year there is data. But in Fulton County, conditions are so bad that the Department of Justice launched an investigation this summer into prisoners' access to medical care and the use of excessive force by the sheriff's office. For a closer look at this, we turn to Shemaine Cruz. She's a criminal justice reporter for public media station WABE in Atlanta. Shemaine, thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us a little bit more about these latest deaths? How are these prisoners dying and under what kinds of circumstances?
Yeah, so I will say that I haven't been inside the facility myself, but the Fulton County Sheriff, Pat Labatt, has long said that the county needs a new jail. He says that the walls are quite literally crumbling to the point that inmates are using some of the material that they're finding around the facility to make shanks and other weapons. Just this week, 4 people were stabbed inside the jail. And that includes a 23-year-old man who died from his injuries. As you said, that makes 9 people who have died at the jail so far this year and 5 in the span of a month. Now, we're still waiting on the results of those autopsies, but Sheriff Pat Labatt has said that they range from natural causes to pre-existing health conditions and even homicide.
I mean, it's just sort of incredible that this is happening in a modern American city. And we should stress, too, that these are people who are not been convicted. They're in jail awaiting trial or sentencing, right?
Yeah, that's right. Officials with the Department of Justice said that about 87% of the jail population is Black, and the vast majority have not been convicted. Most are awaiting bail hearings or simply cannot post bail.
We spoke with a criminal justice reform advocate down there, Atiyah Holly. Here's what she said about the jail.
It is a place that has been steeped in overcrowding and neglect and people receiving poor mental health care, violence. And I think if you look at the spectrum of problems that can occur in a jail, you will see each and almost every problem at the Fulton County Jail.
So, Shemaine, how have complaints been handled in the past about this? I mean, certainly this is not the first time that this has come up as an issue.
Yeah, so this has been happening for years, but the family of a 35-year-old man, his name is LaShawn Thompson, actually launched, the complaint that a lot of people have probably heard about by now. He was being held at the Fulton County Jail for 3 months. He was in the psychiatric ward of the facility, and he was there for just 3 months waiting on a hearing. He had not yet been convicted, and according to an incident report that I saw, he was found unresponsive in his cell, face down in the toilet, and completely covered in bedbugs. An independent autopsy later found that he had been severely neglected and that he had not been receiving the care or the medicine that he needed to treat his mental health condition. After that case came to light, the U.S. Department of Justice announced that it was launching its investigation into living conditions at the jail. And this case, after this case came to light, the county actually spent about $5 million this year to try to improve conditions at the jail. But it's just been, as the sheriff says, it's just been a Band-Aid. Nothing has really been done to relieve the overcrowding, other than also just like renting out bed space in other counties and things like that. But these issues are still happening, still going on.
If the DOJ finds that the sheriff's office or Fulton County has been negligent, what are the possible remedies here?
As far as I know, the county has actually started looking at several options to build a new jail. They think that it would cost about $1.6 billion. And the reason that they say that they went ahead and moved forward with this is because they think that the Department of Justice, after it completes its investigation, is going to force them to build a new facility anyway. Now, we don't know how long this investigation could take, but the county is moving forward with these plans.
The reason everyone started to pay attention to Fulton County Jail nationally was because that's where former President Trump and his co-defendants had to report. We can assume, I take it, that they had markedly different treatment while they were there?
That's right. When this indictment was announced, the Fulton County Sheriff said that they would be treated just like anybody else. But as far as I know, only one co-defendant spent time in a cell at the Fulton County Jail. And former President Donald Trump was only here for about 20 minutes while he was being processed and posted his $200,000 bail. And that's just not the reality for most people who step foot in this facility.
All right. Chimaine Cruz of WABE in Atlanta, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fatal shootings rocked the nation, the former president at the center of unprecedented prosecutions, and the Senate faces questions from within its ranks after another health scare. To analyze all of this and more, Brooks and Capehart, that's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Hi, John.
It seems like a lot of the political news or news relating to politics these days has been in courtrooms. Today, two Proud Boys, former Proud Boys, sentenced to 18 years and 10 years in prison. This week, a judge set Donald Trump's trial date for the conspiring to try to overturn the 2020 election and stay in office for the day before for Super Tuesday. David, could the coming election be overshadowed by the last election?
Yeah, it looks that way, at least the primary season. I have a real problem with the way they've scheduled the pre-Super Tuesday. You know, I understand that the people in the judicial system don't want to be political, but to be completely oblivious to politics and the effects of their actions seems to me somewhat irresponsible. If it really does get held that day, then Trump will be under attack from the establishment the day before Super Tuesday. It will be impossible for any other Republican candidate to get some traction in that circumstance. And so, you know, all these indictments have helped Trump. And so you got to think, okay, you do the indictments, I get it, he deserves to be indicted. But are you aware of what's about to happen because of those indictments? And that's one thing. It's even worse to do it scheduling. A lot of Americans are going to say, he allegedly did these things a bunch of years ago. They've politicized it, and then they schedule it right at Super Tuesday. They're trying to destroy our man. We'll rally around.
Jonathan?
I mean, so then when do you hold the trial? A lot of times we talk about how, you know, judges and the judiciary should keep politics out of their decisions. And so why start now? You know, the former president wanted his trial to go into 2026, and Judge Chutkan was like, no, and rightfully so. I honestly wish that the trial could happen at some point this year so that we get it started and get it going. But I just think it's an accident of timing. We also have to remember that who knows what else is on Judge Chutkan's docket, the other cases that she has to work with. So I'm not so much concerned about when these trials will happen as much as I am excited for them to happen, because this is the one time, well, one of four times that the former president is going to be held accountable for his actions related to the 2020 election.
There's another legal argument that's floating around. Some conservative legal scholars are writing that the 14th Amendment, the Civil War language in the 14th Amendment, should bar Donald Trump from being president again. And it's actually being tested in court. One of the GOP Republican candidates, long shot candidates, is filing suit to test this. Do you think there's anything to that argument?
From the arguments that I've read, I have serious questions, particularly from the two conservative writers who say that, you know, there's no action of Congress that's needed. It's right there. All you need to do is just enforce it. And I read that, and I'm looking at American politics today. I'm looking at state legislatures and elected officials around the country who aren't nearly as honorable as the folks you would need to depend on to make their argument work. I think the key thing is for the American people to make the decision at the ballot box. I'm glad that the candidate in New Hampshire is bringing suit, because at least in that way someone's bringing the question and we will get a legal response. But until then, I think it's up to the American people.
Yeah, there's another case where we have legal scholars making a legal case completely oblivious to the political realities. I think politically their ideas just cloud cuckoo land. We have a country which people are distrustful of institutions, and suddenly their guy gets crossed off the ballot without a hearing, without anything. It just sort of magically disappears. We'd get locked into all sorts of legal concerns about whether Trump really did insurrection or did not. And then if this standard is embraced, do we think Republicans won't want to start throwing off Democrats off the ballot? And so this was a post-Civil War, unique to a situation where you had former Confederate generals potentially getting active in politics. That was a clear threat. They wrote this thing into the Constitution to do that threat. We're not in that circumstance. It should not apply.
This week, we also had what's becoming, unfortunately, fairly routine. We had two shootings, one at the University of North Carolina. The student newspaper at the UNC had their front page filled with text messages and other things, messages sent between the students. It really showed the visceral fear that these students were feeling. But the shooting itself barely made a blip on the radar elsewhere. Are we just becoming too sort of numb to this? I mean, we saw that terror among the students, but are we just becoming too numb to this, David?
We might be becoming a little numb. I confess I was thinking about it today. I think about what we could do to ward off these shootings, the gun control, the red flags. If you see a young suicidal man reading neo-Nazi literature, that ought to be a red flag. That if that's in your neighborhood, if that's in your family, you need to tell somebody about that. And as I was thinking about it, I was thinking, I'm going through the ritual, the routines, the mental routines I go through, thinking, well, we could do a little incrementally to reduce these. But I must say, when you saw the video, which we saw, it still remains freshly shocking and traumatic. But I'm glad the student paper did that to sort of remind the rest of us that this is just raw evil, and you can get inured to it.
Jonathan?
It's way too routine. I mean, it used to be that it was front page news, it was breaking news. This happens so much that sometimes a mass shooting can be a news brief in the newspaper. I think that the Tar Heel did a fantastic job of dramatizing to everyone, to the community, just what they went through, but also to the nation, so that we don't get used to this, even though we've gotten used to it.
Just one quick thing. I would like to see a study done. If you reduce the media coverage, does it reduce the copycats? And I just don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, there was also another shooting in Jacksonville over last weekend where someone who clearly left a lot of writings about his hatred for black Americans, for black people, killed three people. A lot of people in Florida pointing to the lax gun laws in Florida, especially the concealed carry. You can carry a concealed weapon without a permit. Is that a fair connection, David?
Well, I do think if you reduce the, I mean, we have hundreds of millions of guns in this country, so I have low hopes that some gun control legislation will reduce people's ability to get guns. But, you know, I do think that was a case where the guy had previous suicidal tendencies, was reading this crap online, and hopefully, in those cases, hopefully somebody in the family or a friend just can say to somebody, red flag here, because that kind of case, he fit every stereotype of somebody who's going to do this awful thing, and somehow nobody stepped in the way.
But we can't talk about Jacksonville without talking about the political environment around black people, and particularly around black history in Florida. There is a reason Governor DeSantis was booed when he did the right thing by going to the community, but the community booed him for a reason. His so-called anti-woke legislation, what's happening with the teaching of black history in Florida public schools, that sends a message not only to the black community that the governor does not think much of you or your history or your contributions to this country, but it also sends a signal to those people, deranged or not, who believe that black people are inferior and therefore are worthy of extermination. If the governor doesn't want to be booed, he needs to do better, not just in terms of his rhetoric, but also in terms of his legislation.
We got a minute left. We also saw this week another scary episode. Actually, it was very frightening to watch. Mitch McConnell just freezing in mid-sentence. This is the second time in a matter of weeks. Can he, if this happens again or keeps happening, can he lead the Senate in an effective way?
I mean, if it happens again, I don't think so. And as I've said before, I think these situations demand that we as a nation have a conversation about what leaders of that age, what we should expect of them if they want to stay in leadership under those conditions.
Yeah, the leading presidential candidates are 77 and 80. This is the oldest Congress in a century.
Just getting started. You know, I'm not a doctor, but as I understand it, if he is, say, having seizures, then that can be treated, and somebody who has occasional seizures can do a job, can do a serious job. But he has to be clear with us about what's actually happening. The statement from the doctor in the Congress was not clear at all and not trust-inducing.
David, you got the last word. We got to leave it there. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And that is the News Hour for this Friday. Be sure to tune in later tonight for Washington Week with The Atlantic with Jeffrey Goldberg. Jeff, what's coming up?
John, tonight I'll be speaking with some of the country's top journalists about former President Trump's trial date, which is set to begin just one day before Super Tuesday, and also growing concerns about America's aging leaders.
Thanks, Jeffrey. We'll be watching. And you can join me tomorrow on PBS News Weekend for a conversation with former FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate on the lessons learned from the Maui wildfires and Hurricane Idalia and the future of disaster response. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.